My name is Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse. We hope you'll stay tuned. We have our guest with us, Jerry Starr, who is professor of sociology at West Virginia University and director for the Center for Social Studies Education in Pittsburgh and organizer of Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting. Jerry Starr is with us. Jerry, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Mike.
Well, we appreciate it. We have been discussing topics of media on this program for quite some time, and I believe that you were involved in particular around the topic of some television stations in Pittsburgh, in addition to your sort of overall efforts to try and put some public back into public media, correct?
Yeah, that is true, yes.
Talk a little bit about how you got involved in dealing with the media issue, and then we can begin to talk about what some solutions may be to what certainly seems to be an increasing corporatization of the media. I mean, we've been dealing with the whole issue of what's happening with the Pacifica Foundation out here in California. I'm sure you're aware of that as well.
Of course.
Talk, if you will, about how you got involved in all of this.
How I got involved? I've always been a friend of public broadcasting, both television and radio. I've always watched it, listened to it, gave money to it, but I've noticed, I began to be aware over the past several years that there was less and less to watch, less and less to listen to. It was becoming increasingly conservative and commercial and corporate, and it was no longer the alternative to the commercial broadcasting system that it once was. I just withdrew. I became angry about it, but I didn't do anything about it. About 6 years ago, our local public broadcasting complex, WQED Pittsburgh, which has a second station, WQEX, also has a radio station, WQED-FM, and a magazine, Pittsburgh Magazine, made front page news with essentially a financial scandal. They had run up an enormous debt, many millions of dollars, through their own profligacy, mismanagement, and as it turned out, possible embezzlement. The president, the CEO of the station, Lloyd Kaiser, resigned. He dismissed about 25% of the staff. And at that moment, I decided that it was clear that the board of directors of WQED had permitted great indiscretion by management, that it was corporation. It was out of control. It was not responsive to the local community. And I began to organize friends and neighbors. And that grew into something called the QED Accountability Project, which literally had hundreds of people on our mailing list. We had public events. We had letters in the paper. I was permitted to speak to the board of directors. We began to witness board meetings. We began to call for accountability. Through that process, I was named to the Corporate Governance Committee of the station, revising its bylaws. And subsequently to the Community Advisory Board, reviewing its programming and making recommendations for programming that was more responsive to the community. Those were ultimately frustrating experiences. And what I discovered was that that the top-down structure of the station, its lack of accountability to the community, its increasing commercial structure was reflective of public broadcasting throughout the nation and was a product of the pressures that were being brought to bear on public broadcasting from the federal government, from corporate underwriters and others. And that caused us to broaden our outlook and for me to begin to study what was happening in public broadcasting more generally. If you got a minute, I would add also that the next step of our campaign, the WQED board chair and CEO and their supporters decided that to make up this debt that they had run up, they were going to sell off our second public station.
I wanted to get to that because that's really important. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, and they actually managed to use some political muscle to engineer a rather unique piece of legislation that was rushed through with the Omnibus Budget Bill Reconciliation Act of 1993. That would have enabled them to get a 30-day expedited review by the FCC without necessarily any public input to, in effect, de-reserve the station. That is, to make it change it from being a non-commercial station to a commercial station and then to sell it in the marketplace. We, because we had been already active in the community with the QED Accountability Project, we're in a position to oppose this. Of course, we had to get some legal assistance, and that was furnished by David Honig, who's head of the Minority Telecommunications Council, and we opposed the petition that WQED made to the FCC to de-reserve their station. We were told at the time that had they been able to succeed in converting the station to commercial simply on the basis of their claimed fiscal exigency, this would have set up anywhere between 40 and 80 other public television stations for similar conversion. Now, a lot of pressure is being brought to bear on public television to sell off various frequencies to reduce the system in the name of efficiency. Our president of WQED, George Miles, was the chairman of the board of the America's Association of Public Television Stations. He also occupies leads a major task force within the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Very important figure, and he's always been able to rally the support of Irvin Duggan, the head of PBS, of Bob Coonrod, the head of CPB, and of David Brueger, the head of APTS, with any of his schemes. In any event, we succeeded. We actually stopped the dereservation in the summer of 1996. It was a major victory for the public interest. They were forced to go to Plan B. Plan B was to swap signals with a right-wing Christian station, which was licensed commercial, then to sell that station to a third party, which turned out to be Bud Paxson, the infomercial king, who has his own network now, Paxson Network, and it split the money with the right-wing Christian station. Then again, we'd lose our second public television station. The right-wing Christian station, which is called Cornerstone Television, would then move to the frequency that had been occupied by WQEX. We found new legal counsel for that second round, the Institute for Public Representation, the Georgetown University Law Center, and we fought that. That's been going on for 2 years, we've contradicted all the pundits' predictions. They marshaled a tremendous amount of muscle. Almost every corporate CEO in town, both Republican senators, the mayor, a number of very powerful people, even Democratic advisors, a couple of Democratic congressmen, all wrote in support of this license transfer agreement as, in their view, the only antidote to the station's financial problems. We, in contrast, organized tremendous support from public interest groups, organized labor, progressive broadcasters and media critics, thousands of petition signatures, and we've stalled this deal for 2 years. We don't know how it's going to come out, but for 2 years this has now become kind of a national issue and brought me to the attention of a number of people that I hadn't met, leaders of public broadcasting, who disagree with the movement toward increasing commercialism. And I've written a book about the experience. It's going to be published by Beacon Press. And it's not just about my experience or the experience of all the people who participated in this campaign here, but it's about the experience of people in San Francisco and Chicago and Phoenix and towns and cities all over the country who have been fighting for what we call media democracy, to create more space for the public, to be able to talk to each other about their problems, play each other's music, share each other's concerns without fear of corporate censorship or political censorship. And that's the broad-based movement. It led to this idea of Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting. We can't fight these battles one station at a time. Maybe we can create a national movement that would provide the kind of coordination and support and resources for everybody in every town that wants to struggle to improve their community responsiveness and the independence of their public broadcasting service. And so our efforts came to the attention of Bill Moyers and the Schumann Foundation and Jack Willis, an Emmy Award-winning television producer and former head of Twin Cities Public Television, who's at the Open Society Institute. And we're awaiting word any day now that the full funding for the first year of Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting has been granted. We're going to set up an office in Washington, and we're going to begin to build a national coalition of all those people who have been shut out of public broadcasting, all those people who are concerned with education and culture in this country, all those people who fully understand that it's absolutely vital to the preservation of our democratic society that there be some place on the radio dial, some place in the television spectrum where programming can be presented that does justice to the full diversity of voices in our society and is not subject to the censorship of conservative politicians and corporate interests.
We're talking with Jerry Starr, who is with Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting. And Jerry, as I understand it, the book that is being published by Beacon Press is Public Broadcasting in the Public Interest. Is that the working title? That is not the final title?
It may not be.
Okay. So then we probably
What do you think about the war over public broadcasting news from the front?
I like that. I like that. That's really good. Because that's what it is. You know,
it very much is. It's a culture war, you know, and it does include the book got too long, so my editor just cut out the whole section on micro radio, but micro broadcasting.
We have a lot of micro broadcasters who listen to this show. They won't be happy, I can tell you.
Well, fortunately, there are some better books, you know, I mean, full books being devoted to the micro-broadcasting cause, and that was another reason why I was willing to let it go. I've met people who are writing on that issue, as well as people who are writing about Pacifica. So there are people who know more about those issues than I do who are writing about it. But that's a fascinating movement, the micro-broadcasting movement, and it's slowly beginning to succeed. It's quite clear that FCC Chair Bill Kennard and one of the other commissioners, Gloria Tristani, are both very impressed by the outpouring of concern for restoring some legitimate space on the spectrum for communities to provide locally responsive programming, and not to be dominated by the big power stations, which are driven by commercial considerations, and increasingly providing programming that is not locally responsive, that's syndicated and pre-processed and packaged and satellite transmitted. And we want to restore public broadcasting to its founding principles.
There are just so many topics that come to my mind. Let me remind the listeners that we are talking with Jerry Starr of Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting. Jerry, I mean, this really is a war, and we had Bob McChesney on a number of months ago, and we were talking about the fact that what is happening is that with the increasing commercialization and the decreasing commitment of government to fund public media, that what happens is that there is less and less of what might one might refer to as an electronic public square, where issues can be debated and talked about and presented, and not have to worry about whether or not that time is commercially profitable. That we really lose something if we lose this public space, something that could damage our democracy and damage our society forever.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, Bob McChesney, in fact, was part of the working group that developed this proposal for Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting, and he's written several books, and his excellent history of the legislation concerning public radio really documents that, you know, radio was pioneered by churches and labor unions and community groups, and it was intended to serve the public, and that eventually these groups came to be dominated by the large commercial networks who were able to intimidate members of Congress in votes that established the FCC and which awarded the big spectrum to the commercial interests. But nonetheless, in so doing, the public interest was enshrined. There were several principles established and have constantly been ratified by legal challenges that make it very clear that the airwaves belong to the public, that it's absolutely vital that the airwaves belong to the public and serve the public interest. Most people don't really understand this part of it. Broadcasting cannot be a free-for-all. In order for broadcasting to happen, there has to be a recognition that the government must regulate the frequencies in the public interest. The Federal Communications Commission was established for that purpose. It is funded by taxpayer dollars. It grants licensees the privilege of broadcasting on particular frequencies, and you know most of the frequencies are commercial, which means that they can use those frequencies to sell audiences to advertisers. That's basically the way it works. It's kind of a license to make money, according to Newton Minow. It's one of the most profitable industries in the country. They sell audiences to advertisers, and they make enormous amounts of money. But in exchange for that, they're supposed to provide public interest programming, public service announcements, news, other kinds of things. And over the years, in the commercial broadcasting, those responsibilities have been whittled away. The fairness doctrine is gone. There's no need now for them to provide equal time for opposing views. Most public service announcements are at 2 or 3 in the morning.
Right.
The typical half-hour news program now has 9 minutes of commercials. It it has become more and more bottom line. And this has all been exacerbated by the trend that Bob McChesney and a great many other people have been documenting, the Mark Crispin Miller, the Project on Media Ownership, the increasing concentration of media. There's now about a dozen corporations, major, big, giant corporations, that control the book, magazine, newspaper, television, radio, and film industries. These are big corporations that own other corporations.
We're down to about six or so, I think, for the entire world, something like that.
It's an amazing concentration. And of course, when these mergers and acquisitions occur, they're primarily with respect to the bottom line. The first thing they do is to increase the advertising revenue and cut staff. Now, when people kind of dilute a product in order to increase profits, this always hurts consumers. But we're talking not just about breakfast cereal here. We're talking about the information that people get, what they need in order to make a decision about their government, about their communities, about their lives. And so the very democratic process, the participation of the public in community decisions is threatened when information is controlled by very few powerful corporate entities who are driven by profit rather than the public interest. That's why it's essential that we have a public alternative that is free of those influences.
We're talking with Jerry Starr of Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting. One of the things that I wanted to ask you, because I've been having a debate with a friend, and you know, we're talking about how are we going to present some solutions regarding these type of problems. And I know you talked a little bit about what happened in Pittsburgh, but if you could you talk a little bit about what our listeners might do to try and really help turn this thing around? Because as I see it, if we don't do something, if things kind of keep going the way we're going, I mean, we get something which I may start referring as the JFK Jr. syndrome, where we have, you know, just incessant 24-hour-a-day coverage of, you know, I mean, what is certainly a tragedy. I mean, there's no question it is a tragedy. This young man and his family, part of his family, has died. Yet we have worldwide news organizations that muster millions, if not billions, of dollars in resources to cover this, when there are any number of stories which are much more important, much more vital to not only the people of this country, but the people of the world, which go completely ignored. And then these large corporations say, well, you know, we don't have the money or the time to cover that.
Right.
You know, I mean, can you talk a little bit about what people might actually do in their communities beginning today?
Well, when we organized in Pittsburgh, we also had the benefit of an umbrella organization called the Alliance for Progressive Action, which was a coordinating group for about 50 public interest groups in the community. If you've got one of those in your community, you know, we're public interest groups, churches, labor union locals, women's groups, civil rights groups, and groups concerned with consumer environmental issues are in communication with each other, your collective clout is significantly greater than if you're simply representing one group. Even if you don't, however, you can create a kind of media watch committee that includes representatives of several of those groups. For example, in Phoenix, they didn't have such an umbrella group, but they created a Phoenix Media Watch group that included a representative from Amnesty International, a representative from the National Lawyers Group, and so on and so forth. These are all organizations that are concerned with good government, concerned with a fair and accurate reporting, with civic journalism, with simply improving the media culture within which people become educated and informed, and with making it more responsive to their public service needs. They would do a variety of things. They'd visit with managing editors of newspapers and talk to them about the columns that they're running and the columns they're not running. They would talk to them about how they could get better coverage of their events and their meetings and their issues. What we did in Pittsburgh is we actually contracted, and there are several people who do this. Jason Salzman has a group in Denver. Peter Wirth has a group in Syracuse that actually provide media training workshops for activists and for community people that make them more understanding of how journalists in their community operate and how they can be more effective in getting their news into the paper and their reports, you know, on the radio station. Of course, programs like yours are very vital. Community radio stations, alternative weeklies are very vital. And that sometimes reporters in the dailies and in the major broadcast stations do read those, pay attention to those, don't want to be scooped, will be responsive to stories that break there. Developing relationships with journalists, not simply giving up and assuming that because these larger trends constrain the extent of legitimate news coverage that takes place, that it's a hopeless endeavor. I think that it's not. I think you really have to just become more persistent and skillful in pitching stories to local newspapers and to local radio and television broadcast stations. And we've actually done quite a few interviews and talk shows because we've been skillful and persistent in framing our issues and in providing information and in making friends with journalists and in reinforcing those relationships. So there's a lot you can do on the local level simply to get yourself in front of the people who make and disseminate the news to become a part of that process. It's definitely a political process, and in the absence of your input, they're simply going to rip and read the wire services and the other canned information. They're going to take the public relations reports from the corporations in the community and from government officials, and that's what you're going to get reported as the news. The other thing is to work at the, and I would also strongly recommend in the context of all of this, your public broadcasting station. They are mandated, you know, by federal law, by Corporation for Public Broadcasting and FCC rules and regulations, to have a community advisory board that tells them what the community, what kinds of programs the community should be getting, and to review the programming schedule to see if, in fact, different constituencies in the community are being served. And the primary purpose of public broadcasting is to be responsive to those who are unserved and underserved by commercial broadcasting. In other words, those kinds of folks who don't really have a lot of money to spend on products, who are not of great interest to commercial broadcasters, older folks, children, racial minorities, radicals, artists, all kinds of folks who make up the diversity of a community who may not be interesting to advertisers, but who constitute citizens, taxpayers, listeners, viewers, and worthy participants in the political process.
Absolutely. We're talking with Jerry Starr of Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting. I mean, Jerry, you bring up a couple of points, and we have to begin to work our way out of this segment. But two things that come to my mind is, one is that I've been doing programming on this radio station for several years and have regularly invited people to come in with free speech announcements and so forth and so on. And very few people actually take you up on that. And, you know, what I'm hearing you say is that what people have to do is get involved. And there's a lot of ways to get involved and to get involved in all forms of media in your area and go to them and say, look, you know, this is what's going on. And I, you know, what are you doing to serve our community here? And to also to do that in a way by learning how the business, for lack of a better word, of media is done, and making your message one that is easier for the people who are doing media to deal with, therefore you will increase your exposure. It's an educational and activist project that work together.
Absolutely. And there are groups also that you should be aware of. I would recommend a book called We the Media that's published by the Institute for Alternative Journalism. It's just a wonderful resource guide. It alerts you to all the resources and the organizations that can support you in this kind of an effort. Groups like Project Censored, which you know, in which broadcasters and experts give you a list of the 10 stories of the year that were least covered by the mainstream media, but were important stories that people should know about, or groups like the Rocky Mountain Media Watch in Denver, which conducts periodic surveys of local television news content. They get people like you and me to videotape the half-hour television news, and then they send it in, they content analyze it, and they give you a report on what's covered in the news. They have a kind of mayhem index and a fluff index
right.
to give you an idea of what local television news has become and how your station compares to the others and what you can do to make it better. What we're doing at the national level, Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting, is setting up an office in Washington, D.C. to develop a campaign to restructure public broadcasting as an independent public trust. We think it should be subsidized by the profits from the commercial broadcasting industry. That spectrum that commercial broadcasters get from the FCC, which allows them to make such huge profits, they don't pay anything for that, which is unheard of. And you know, all over the world, public broadcasting is funded by a public trust, and all over the world, broadcasters pay a fee for their spectrum, but they don't do it here. If you were to graze your cattle on public land or to drill for oil on public land, you'd pay a fee, but they don't pay a fee for public broadcasting. So for commercial broadcasting licenses, I should say. So there are any number of ways you could fund it. It would be a spectrum license fee or a tax on advertising or a spectrum auction tax or a tax on license transfers. And any of those taxes, 2 to 5%, would generate $1 billion, which would be plenty of money to make public broadcasting, coupled with its current state and subscriber contributions, a very vital service that would provide a diversity of local and national programming, both for television and radio, and be completely off the congressional dole. No longer that lousy 15% they give a cause for threatening and bullying public broadcasters
right.
because politicians don't like this or that program.
We've been talking with Jerry Starr, who is with Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting. Jerry, thank you for being with us on the program. I would really like to have you on again if we can. And also, if there is any contact information or any way that people in our audience can be supportive of this, because I think in the final analysis, the solution that you're proposing here, whereby a financial base is laid that is then truly independent from political and commercial pressures, is really the way to go. Any way that people can be more supportive of what you're trying to do here?
Yeah, absolutely. We when we get the office set up in Washington, we'll have a web page and a listserv, but in the meantime, if people want to get on our mailing list, they can write to Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting, or CIPB. They can write to 901 Old Hickory Road. That's in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 15243.
We can
give you a telephone number as well.
Go ahead.
You want me to repeat that address?
Yes, repeat the address, and then let's also give the phone number twice for people so they
All right.
can get it.
It's CIPB, 901 Old Hickory Road, Pittsburgh, PA, 15243. Telephone number would be 412-341-1967. That's 412-341-1967. We've also got a fax. That you can, if you want to fax your name and address to be put on the mailing list, or to participate, or especially if you want to be a local organizer, and when we get the campaign going, and that's 412-341-6533. The fax number again is 412-341-6533.
Jerry Starr of Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting, thank you for being with us on the program, and I really do hope we can have you on again.
Well, thanks, Mike. Good luck with your show.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this edition of the program. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. If you're interested in copies of this or other Full Logic Reverse programs, you can contact us via email at flr@jps.net or by telephone at area code 530-265-9462. Full Logic Reverse is produced at FLR Studios in Nevada City, California, USA. Our music is by Rick Payne. We hope you'll join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.